From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And on Twitter this morning, President Trump once again accused Democrats of not wanting to make a deal on extending deportation protections for young undocumented immigrants known as Dreamers. And last night at his Florida golf club, Trump was asked if he was a racist after he reportedly used that crude term in a meeting last week when talking about immigrants from Haiti and African countries.
No, I'm not a racist. I am the least racist person you have ever interview.
And what exactly did the president say about his friendship with the leader of North Korea? Lots going on, so let's bring in NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. Hi, Scott.
Good to be with you.
So to the president's reported use of the word S-hole to describe countries in Africa and Haiti, to remind us, the Democrat Dick Durbin said he did. But yesterday you have Georgia Senator David Perdue telling this to ABC's George Stephanopoulos.
I'm telling you, he did not use that word, George, and I'm telling you, it's a gross misrepresentation. How many times do you want me to say that?
And then on CBS Face the Nation, host John Dickerson pressed Arkansas Republican Senator Tom Cotton.
I did not hear derogatory comments
about
individuals or persons, no.
Okay, so this sentiment is totally phony as well, that is attributed to him.
Yes.
Well, so both Perdue and Cotton initially said last week that they didn't recall the president saying these comments specifically. Now, Lindsey Graham was reported to have rebuked the president in that meeting for his words. He doesn't deny those reports. And today he said, my memory has not evolved, implying the criticism of the other Republicans in that meeting who now seem certain about what the president said. What is going on here?
Well, listeners can judge for themselves, but in making that judgment, here are some facts they might want to consider. When the initial reports of the president's vulgar slur came out on Thursday night, there was no denial from the White House. Trump reportedly spent some time that evening calling friends to see how the remark was playing. On Friday, we had the comments from Dick Durbin emphatically describing what he called the president's vile, hate-filled, and racist remarks. And at that time, Perdue and Cotton issued a very carefully worded statement where they said they did not recall the president using that kind of language. At the same time, two other Republican senators, Tim Scott and Jeff Flake, who were not in the meeting, said they had heard accounts similar to what was being widely reported in the meeting. As you say, Lindsey Graham, again today, told the Post-Courier newspaper in South Carolina, my memory has not evolved. I know what was said, and I know what I said.
Okay, so listeners, take that all in. And take in what we're about to talk about. Trump and the Wall Street Journal got into a fight over what Trump said in an interview last week about his relationship with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Now, the president is accusing the newspaper of deliberately misquoting him as saying, I probably have a very good relationship with Kim. Trump says he was actually saying, I would probably have a very good relationship. You know, hypothetical. The White House and the newspaper released recordings. So let's listen. Here's what the Journal put out.
And I'd probably have a very good relationship with Kim Jong-un of North Korea.
And here's what the White House put out.
And I'd probably have a very good relationship with Kim Jong-un.
Scott Horsley, it sounds to me like he's saying I would.
Yeah, it's a close call. The president had an opportunity to sort of clear this up during the interview because immediately after that exchange, the Wall Street Journal came back and said, just to be clear, you haven't spoken to the North Korean leader. I mean, when you say you have a relationship with Korea, and the president responded, quote, I don't want to comment on it. I don't want to comment. I'm not saying I have or I haven't.
Okay. So, again, listeners, you listen. Possible Utah Senate candidate Mitt Romney tweeted this morning about the president's alleged remarks in that meeting. Romney writes, the poverty of an aspiring immigrant's nation of origin is as irrelevant as their race. The sentiment attributed to POTUS is inconsistent with America's history and antithetical to American values. May our memory of Dr. King buoy our hope for unity, greatness, and charity for all. Is Romney running for Senate?
It certainly looks that way. This is not the first time the Republicans' 2012 nominee has gone after their 2016 nominee. Romney, during the primary, was harshly critical of Donald Trump. He attacked his business record, called him a phony and a fraud. He also criticized the president after Trump's equivocal response to the white nationalist demonstration in Charlottesville. So it will be interesting to see if we do get a Senator Romney from Utah, how he deals with the president. Of course, Trump worked hard to head off a Romney Senate bid by trying to persuade Orrin Hatch to seek re-election in Utah. That effort was unsuccessful.
Yeah. NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. And Scott, by the way, may you have a thoughtful Martin Luther King Day.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Same to you.
Let's turn now to a new front in the fight against cancer. We usually think of vaccines as preventing illness, but some cancer researchers hope to create a vaccine that will treat the disease. And they've made progress recently on a whole new mode of fighting cancer called a personal cancer vaccine, a treatment that would be custom made for a single patient. Carrie Goldberg of member station WBUR reports.
Martha Pfeiffer knew she was at high risk for melanoma, a potentially deadly skin cancer.
I had a gazillion sunburns as a kid. It was sort of the classic thing my poor mother tried and tried.
In 2012, she felt a new mole on the back of her arm.
And I said, I don't remember that. And I looked at it. I didn't think much of it, and I didn't go running right in. But sure enough, that one turned out to be the one that I got the call about.
The mole was melanoma. Pfeiffer had surgery to remove the tumor and the lymph nodes under her arm. A couple of years later, more melanoma turned up and she needed more surgery. Not an uncommon course of events so far, but now it gets futuristic. She qualified for a study at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston that began by taking cells from her tumor to analyze their DNA.
And then they did a genetic mapping of the cells, and they were able to isolate the mutated cells that were specific to the melanoma. And that's where the cooking comes in.
The cooking uses a scientific recipe that was published recently in the journal Nature. You take those unique tumor mutations and you use prediction algorithms to choose about 20 of them as likely to be your best targets. Then you make a vaccine that trains the patient's immune system to attack only cells with those targets. You add a booster that stimulates the patient's immune response.
We actually create and synthesize a vaccine just for that individual, so it never existed anywhere else in the world and will never again because only that person has that cancer.
Nir Hakohen is an immunologist at Massachusetts General Hospital and the Broad Institute. He says you then inject the vaccine into the patient's arms or legs multiple times, and if all goes well, the patient's own immune cells will hunt down the tumor cells that they're now trained to recognize, even if the cancer has spread.
When they find the tumor, or any piece of the tumor, they'll start to attack it. And the hope is to be able to get this vaccine to work strongly enough to completely eliminate the tumor, not to just kill a little bit of it.
Familiar vaccines, like the shots against measles or chickenpox, also train our own immune system to recognize and kill an invader. But this personal vaccine is what's called a therapeutic vaccine. It treats an illness rather than prevents it. For decades, the quest for a therapeutic vaccine against cancer has frustrated researchers. Dr. Catherine Wu at Dana-Farber and the Broad Institute says even a couple of years ago, cancer vaccines did not look promising.
When I was a postdoc, all the literature was about how vaccines didn't work. There were plenty of studies, clinical trials, that could see laboratory evidence of immune responses, but it didn't do anything for the patients.
Now there's been dramatic progress on analyzing tumor DNA and on treatments that harness the patient's own immune system to fight cancer. Traditional cancer treatments like chemotherapy can cause harsh side effects because they attack healthy cells along with the cancer. But a personal cancer vaccine is so precisely targeted at tumor cells that the side effects can be no worse than a mild flu. Dr. Glenn Dranoff with the pharmaceutical company Novartis is a longtime leader in cancer vaccines. He says these personal vaccines successfully combine the power of cancer genetics with new insights into the immune system.
So the work is scientifically very compelling.
It's a novel approach, he says, an elegant proof of concept, but
whether or not that's going to translate into better outcomes for cancer patients is going to require significant more study and clinical testing.
That will take extensive clinical trials. It also remains to be seen how much personal cancer vaccines could cost. Some other new cancer treatments run hundreds of thousands of dollars. Clinical trials are now underway to try this type of personal vaccine for lung and bladder cancer and glioblastoma, the brain cancer. So interest is high, but these are early days. Martha Pfeiffer was one of just six melanoma patients in the two-year study that was published in Nature. Her scans have remained clear so far, but she has no guarantee the cancer will not recur.
I'm going on the assumption that this is working, but people say to you, oh, did the vaccine work? And my response is, you only know if it doesn't work, really.
Whatever happens, Pfeiffer is a pioneer patient in the exploration of new cancer treatments that involve a personal drug developed for each patient. For Here and Now, I'm Carrie Goldberg.
And we are a little under a month away from the 2018 Olympics in Pyeongchang, South Korea. And as we make our way to February 8th, we're going to be checking in with athletes from Team USA, starting today with loser Erin Hamlin. This will be her fourth and likely final Olympic season. In 2014, she became the first female American loser to medal at any Winter Olympics, earning the bronze. She's been in the world's top 10 for the past 11 years. She joins us by Skype from Oberhof, Germany, where she just placed eighth in a World Cup race there. Erin, talk about that first. You're focused on these World Cup races right now, but you're going to be in the Olympics. Where do you put that in your head?
It's definitely hard not to keep them from creeping up into the forefront, but for the most part, it's really important for us in these last three races to have decent results because it can affect our seeding points going into the games, which impacts where we will be in the order.
Talk about that. Seeding. Who goes first, second, third? Why is that important?
Yeah, so when we race, you obviously want the best ice, and the best ice will happen right out of the gate. So the way that they set it up in races is the people within the top 12 will be in what we call the A seed, and they will actually re-spritz, which is a quick layer of water on the track, so kind of like a Zamboni at a hockey rink, mm-hmm. but people just do it with hoses. They'll do that before the A seed goes, so we'll get kind of like a refresher of the ice, which is pretty important.
Yeah, because as you said, you want the best ice. Look, we just want to note, because it's always worth noting, you were born into luge land, upstate New York, and it's surprising to remember that the first run was only built in the U.S. in Montana in 1965, the first artificial track for the 1980 Olympics at Lake Placid, another built in Salt Lake for the 2002 Games. This is such a relatively new sport for the U.S. Did you take it up because it's right in your backyard there at Lake Placid?
You know, it's funny I didn't because I was close. It made it a lot easier to continue on in the sport. They do a series called the Slider Search. When I was a kid, it was the Verizon Slider Search, and they basically put kids on a really basic sled with rollerblade wheels at like a city park or just on a city street, and they do these clinics all over the U.S. And so they did one of those in Syracuse, New York. My dad worked for Verizon at the time, so had seen an ad in like a company newsletter. And then once I showed potential from there, I got invited to go to Lake Placid. And being close made it very possible for me to continue on because some kids would have to fly every time, and that wouldn't have been something my family would have been able to do. So thankfully, I was conveniently located to the track. I think I had seen the sport before, but didn't really know much about it and really didn't know what I was getting myself into when I tried out.
Well, thankfully for us, you did, and Lake Placid was right there. But let's talk a little bit about it. I mean, we know you sit in a sled face up, feet pointed downhill. It seems insane to many of us, but how do you manage the sled?
Luge is pretty unique in that there's really no other sport or activity that you can take the skills from and put them into being a really successful luge athlete. That's one reason why we start kids so young. There's a lot of intricate details and learning a lot of, you know, basic physics on the track, you know, going down and the way that gravity pulls you through different corners. There is essentially an ideal line that's imaginary that goes from point A to point B, start to finish down the track. And our goal is to be within an inch of that. And using the corners and the pressure in the corners from gravity and everything to try and steer as little as possible, because every time we steer, it's digging the runners into the ice, and it does cause more friction, slows us down a little bit. And we're doing all that while laying back and mostly not looking and trying to be as relaxed as possible.
Yeah, you have to be almost calm when you do it.
Yeah.
How do you do that? Because, look, in 2010, a loser died going 90 miles per hour on a training run at the Winter Olympics in Canada. Just a terrible, terrible moment. And we understand that forced some track changes to slow things down.
Yes.
Can you even be conscious of how fast you're going and still remain calm?
Yeah, you know, some days you can definitely tell how fast you're going. A lot of times when you get offline and you make a couple of mistakes, it's way more apparent. But oddly enough, your body and your brain kind of get used to it and can be comfortable. It takes a long, long time. It took me, I feel like, until only 5 or 6 years ago. But that's when you can start to relax more and have better position, better aerodynamic position on a sled, which will mean you're going blind a lot. But yeah, it's definitely harder some days than others. And even now, like, we just finished a training session here, and it's not a track that I've always been super comfortable on. So I was not going blind, and I was definitely a little more tense than normal.
Is it mostly a mind game? Or, I mean, I'm assuming, I mean, you're an athlete. Are you also lifting weights and stuff to have the strength?
There's definitely a strength component. At our start, we're actually seated, and we pull off of a set of handles and then paddle with spiked gloves on the ice anywhere from 3 to 5 or 6 times. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of where our strength training is focused around, a lot of upper body core. And then when we're going down the track, we do a lot of neck strengthening because, you know, sometimes we're hitting up to 5 or 6 G's in corners. So we have to be able to hold our heads up, which we can't always do. There are some times where we call it losing your head, which is a little not too pleasant sounding, but it's basically just when the G forces get too strong and our heads get pulled back so we can't see anything.
Well, there. And do we mention there's no brakes?
Sounds great.
Yeah, right.
No brakes.
Look, you won the 2009 world title at Lake Placid, becoming the first U.S. woman to win a world title. You took the world title in sprint luge last winter, and as we said, a medal last Olympic season. How do you approach this? Do you think, and this year I'm going to get a silver or a gold? I mean, or do you not think about it?
It's pretty interesting. You know, it's, I think, impossible for an athlete, especially week in and week out, when I know if I slide as best I can and to what I'm capable of, I can compete for a medal. Like, that's something that's realistic. It's just a matter of doing it when it counts and having 2 good runs, and for the Olympics, 4 good runs on the day of. So for me at this point, you know, I've already accomplished more than I ever imagined I would. I've been in the sport longer than I thought I would. So yeah, obviously I'm going to gun for a medal. I'm going for it, but it's not going to make or break my career whether or not I walk away with one from this Olympics. But yeah, it's just, I want to go and enjoy it and, know that I left it all on the ice. And in my career, I did that and I just have fun. You know, that's the biggest thing for me.
This is the end.
Yeah. This will be my last Olympics, last international race, last go around. Yeah. It's been a long, fun, exciting road, but, while I'm still healthy and youngish and ambitious, I want to take that and put it towards other fun adventures and things.
Well, plus, you're getting married this summer in upstate New York, which, how lucky are you?
I am.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm very, very happy for that next chapter.
Yeah, at Remsen, New York. Erin Hamlin, who will be competing in luge for the U.S. at the upcoming Winter Olympics. Erin, best to you in everything.
Thank you very much.
Well, nearly a third of the kids in this country between the ages of 10 and 17 are not getting this kind of activity. They are overweight or obese. Most are way too sedentary. And often it's because they're not getting phys ed in school. But several schools in Wisconsin are working to transform phys ed to give kids the tools to keep a healthy outlook throughout their lives. Rachel Morello from member station WUWM reports from the city of Wauwatosa.
By 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, the kids at Longfellow Middle School in Wauwatosa know the rules of the game. Now it's time to play.
Mario!
Today, it's floor hockey.
Mario!
Defense! Teams face off in gameplay upstairs in the gym. Downstairs, it's weight training and cardio activities like running laps or using the elliptical. Students suit up for action every other day. But don't call it gym class around teacher Nancy Bradigan.
It's not gym. It's physical education.
Bradigan coordinates physical education curriculum for middle and high schools in Wauwatosa, and she's the lead teacher here at Longfellow. She wants to change the mindset around phys ed.
A lot of people have that perception of it's just gym. Well, I don't want that to be the perception here at Longfellow or in TOSA in general. I want kids and parents and the community members to understand that we are here educating your student lifelong, that we are not just a regular gym class.
The goal here is activity, measured by kids' heart rates, which are tracked by monitors they're wearing under their bright orange Longfellow PE t-shirts. The sensors sync up to an app on the teacher's iPad, which they hook up to a projector screen so kids can clearly see how they're doing. 25 minutes in their target heart rate zone essentially equals a passing grade for the day, which sometimes means cramming at the end of class.
40 more seconds.
I need X for this amount of time, and they come over and they're running in place.
I'm at 19 minutes and 30 seconds.
So I'm at 23.
I just want to get 20 minutes. At least.
Kids get to choose which activity they do each day, as long as they get an even mix of cardio, gameplay, and weight training over the course of the school year.
Their actual target heart rate zone is specific to them. Because you'll have those kids that, you know, when they're down in cardio, brisk walk helps. Other kids have to run. So we wanted to make sure that it was an even playing field for everybody.
The use of fitness technology and health club style activities is nothing new. Plenty of schools incorporate these things, much of it funded by federal grant money. But it's not just a matter of offering the equipment. Bradigan says it's giving the students ownership over their own fitness, and in turn, their own learning.
Our district really wants kids to be independent. When we take away the skills and they don't worry about winning and they just enjoy playing like you would normally, it gives them ownership and it puts the responsibility on them, and they more likely will be more active.
Wisconsin students are required to take some form of phys ed during the school day every year from kindergarten through eighth grade and across at least 3 years of high school. And now, several other schools in the state are looking to follow Wauwatosa's lead and hoping to phase more choice into students' physical education. For Here and Now, I'm Rachel Morello.
Electricity from renewable energy sources will soon be consistently cheaper than the energy from fossil fuels. This prediction comes in a new report from the International Renewable Energy Agency, and they predict that this will happen worldwide in 2020. And already, in many parts of the world, renewable energy is competitive with fossil fuel. But Robin Farzad, host of Full Disclosure on NPR One, not just competitive, but consistently cheaper than the energy from fossil fuels. And 2020 doesn't seem like that far away.
It's exciting stuff. I mean, right now, fossil fuel-generated power, you know, smokestacks, carbon, costs anywhere from about 5 to 17 cents per kilowatt hour. But as demand for renewables increases and you see the attendant expertise climb the learning curve, everything from hydropower, onshore wind, geothermal, solar, photovoltaics, they all fall comfortably within that price range. So if you're building out power infrastructure with, say, like a 40-year lifespan, it's now far easier to make a good return on the investment.
Okay, we always want to consider the source. And this study does come from an agency that focuses on renewable energy. So is there data to back up their findings?
I mean, this data is kind of fungible. You can find these points on a Bloomberg or Reuters terminal. State regulatory commissions and companies are increasingly abiding by them. And you look at utilities in places like California and Western Europe, they depend on these figures to make hundreds of billions of dollars in large-scale investments in renewables. So even on a mom-and-pop level, more and more homeowners are relying on these numbers to ditch the grid and go solar. So you're seeing it everywhere.
Yeah. And what exactly are we seeing? What kinds of technology? You mentioned a couple. And also, what are the biggest barriers to this coming true?
Well, look, it sounds so darn enticing, like Mother Nature is practically begging you to take her energy, right? Mm-hmm. Every hour, the sun hits the earth with enough light to meet a whole year of our energy needs. The problem is utilities, by law, have to provision customers 24/7. And the sun doesn't always shine, the wind don't always blow, so you can't just quit fossil fuels cold turkey regardless of price. Mm-hmm. You need them as a crutch. But in improving technology and storage and grid, works will change this codependency, and it's happening faster really than anybody had imagined.
Yeah, you'll still need nuclear to fill in the gaps, people are saying. But what about the political barrier? We know newer industries often subsidized by the government. The Obama administration did a lot of that. Now we have the Trump administration looking to bring back jobs in coal, rolling back a lot of Obama-era decisions, encouraging more open water oil drilling. So might that change this report, this 2020 target?
It's a huge grain of salt that you have to consider. But still, Robin, over time, it's hard to fight against economic appeal. You know, it's never easy to wrest a bone from the jaws of a powerful dog, the utilities. Mm-hmm. They're in no rush to see their bill-paying customers cover their roofs in solar and cut the cord and leave the power grid. They've spent a century and untold amounts on fossil fuel-centric infrastructure, and they have a lot of money to lobby lawmakers to help prolong the status quo. But not all of them. I mean, you could look at California, which is like its own nation. The state is now requiring its biggest utilities to default to renewables during peak demand. And that kind of adoption, it's only going to speed the learning curve and make renewables more accessible and affordable nationwide, even globally.
I think you just heard a cheer from the West Coast when you said California, almost its own nation. Robin Farzad, host of Full Disclosure on NPR One. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Today is Martin Luther King Day, when many think of bridging divides, something author Gis Jen has been thinking about for years. She's the American-born daughter of Chinese immigrants who came to the U.S. in the 1940s, and that informs her writing about a multicultural America in novels like 1991's Typical American and 2004's The Love Wife. But more recently, Gis Jen has turned her eye on nonfiction explorations of the East-West divide that she straddles. Her 2013 book, Tiger Writing, looked at East-West differences in art and architecture. And then there's 2017's The Girl at the Baggage Claim, Explaining the East-West Culture Gap. That book comes out in paperback this week. We spoke with Gis Jen when it was first published. And, you know, I thought at the outset, when you set up certain ways of characterizing East and West cultures, I thought, whoa, you can get into, you know, dangerous territory here, because there are cultural truths, but there are also stereotypes, you know,
absolutely,
misunderstandings we have. So, you know, many Americans grew up viewing the Japanese, the Chinese, as people who would just walk in lockstep, whereas Americans were, you know, John Wayne. That's the stereotype. But
right,
what were you trying to say about what are some real cultural differences?
Well, the fact of the matter is there are differences. There are underlying cultural differences. Now, in the West, we see those differences and we see them through our lens, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why we see a self which is different, and then we say, oh, they're robots and they're sheep. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm trying to say is, yes, you are looking at something which is not you, but you are not looking at robots and you are not looking at sheep.
And they may not be looking at Americans who are just individuals who don't care about anyone else. I mean, there's sort of a two-way mirror here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They look at us. They think we're unbelievably cold and unfeeling. You know, they look at the way we treat our elderly. You know, they think that we're really not as human as they are.
Right. So you come up with these descriptions. I love the ones for Americans. They, the more individualistic, are like avocados with big pits in the middle. So we're, you know, we're all about our big pit in the middle.
Our sacred pit.
Right. Asians are the flexi self. They're more concerned with ties to family and country. You mentioned taking care of the elderly. You begin your book with the story of a girl who arrives from China. She's the girl at the baggage claim in the title. She's supposed to be studying at a prestigious school. She has great grades, test scores. But the people, the Americans meeting her, find out she is not the girl they were corresponding with. They are not her test scores. That's not her resume. And yet they're stunned because no one on the Chinese end seems to be bothered by that.
And of course, when I heard the story, of course, you know, I share their shock in the sense that, you know, this is definitely not okay.
Well,
right?
It's fraud.
It's fraud. It's absolutely not okay. But the kind of fraud it was, do you know what I mean? The foreignness of the fraud, I felt like, you know, actually, I can tell you a little bit about how it is that the idea of substituting one person for another, which is so taboo in the West, how is it that that is you know, I wouldn't say it's okay in the East, but it's just much more common. It's something like, you know, if you hear somebody was over the speed limit when they were driving, well, we all know that the speed limit is 65, and how is it that some people go 75 and, you know, it's not the end of the world, right? Well, how is it that they look at things like substituting one person for another a little bit the way that we look at the speed laws? You know, the flexi self sees itself as kind of part of a group, as part of a team. You know, just as the team, if, you know, your shortstop is out, you know, your first baseman might kind of move into that role. Of course, each individual is different from the next individual, but the question is how emphasizes that, you know, how much importance do we attach to that? And we here in the West, we attach enormous importance to that, but they don't.
Again, we're talking about the flexi self, which is your name for the Asian. But you pick up this thought with copying an artwork or copying ideas is far more respected in China, for instance, than it would be here. Which answers some questions about why you could have. Is it Alibaba that you speak of?
Yeah.
You know, it's not as much innovating an idea. It's about how do you get an idea that's already there and put it out. And that kind of explains some of the copyright infringement.
Absolutely. You know, we have developed this idea, right, that we have this thing, the self. Yeah. Well, what if you never really had that idea? You know, what if you grew up on Confucius and Buddhism? You know, what if you had a completely idea, a different idea?
What would that mean, Confucius?
Well, for one thing, instead of feeling like the source of everything which is the most true comes from the self, which is what we believe, what if you thought that everything that is the most true comes from society? Mm-hmm. And so your idea is that first and foremost, before you add anything to this great tradition, you must absorb. Mm-hmm. Well, in that case, you know, copying is not such a bad thing. And let me just sort of say, you know, so a lot of the sort of Eastern ideas about education that include copying, that include a memorization, for us, they're taboo because those things, they're not coming from within, right? So we don't like that.
They're just rote.
We see it as rote. And the fact of the matter is, if we were memorizing, we would probably memorize in quite a rote way. But actually, in the East, when they're memorizing, it's not the same activity. They are not just memorizing in a rote way. They are internalizing. And so copying has been, you know, you can understand that, you know, Song Dynasty, you know, emperors, everybody copied. The copying tradition is a tradition that goes back thousands and thousands of years. And really, when you elect to copy someone, it is a mark of tremendous respect. And every painter learns to paint this way. People learn to write this way. And once you have absorbed the great tradition, then you can add to it. Well, now, I'm not defending, you know, the copyright infringement. I'm a writer, you know. I'm in favor of copyright laws. But you can sort of see that if you come from that kind of tradition, the whole idea that you would be expected never to copy and that the idea that copying is taboo is just a very, very strange idea. And you can understand that that's how the West works. But foundationally, it is not your culture.
Well, you are at heart a fiction writer. So how do you, I mean, when you're creating characters and when you're, how are you applying it where, you know, there is the stereotype and the expectation, but you have this insight into what the culture is and you might flesh that out in a character?
Well, honestly, when I'm writing, I'm just writing. If you ask me later, I might say, well, you know, I understand that this particular conflict is there because someone is coming from one culture and they're coming to a culture where things are read differently.
Can you give an example of that?
Well, yeah, I can an example would be there's a nanny in my novel, The Love Wife. She's coming from the mainland. And this family, you know, is very welcoming. And they give her an apartment over the garage. By doing that, they mean to allow her to have some privacy, right, so that she has her own place. But she feels that she is treated as an outsider from the beginning and that she is not treated as a family member and that she has basically been exiled to this apartment over the garage. And, you know, and things go downhill from there.
Meanwhile, a Westerner might die for the apartment over the garage to have the privacy, their own bathroom.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Their own bathroom. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And they would not feel that they were being held at arm's length. And they would not feel that was a cold gesture. They would feel it was a considerate gesture.
Fascinating. We've just touched the surface of this, Gishchen. But I want to mention one aspect that you share. You got in trouble for writing from your flexi self. You write many commentaries, and you wrote one for the Boston Globe about what the Red Sox World Series victory in 2013 meant to the city still reeling from the Boston bombings. And you just touched in a kind of a sidebar on Jahar Zanayev, one of the bombers, the younger one, full disclosure, you and I both knew him or knew of him from being in this area. And you wondered from your flexi self point of view, gee, what happened to him? What formed this? What? And you were excoriated for that.
Yeah, absolutely. But I stand by the question. I mean, I think that because the flexi self is more oriented towards society, you know, and there's a perceptual difference, by the way. So, you know, if you have a lion in a savanna, you know, the flexi self will see the savanna and will also tend to look to the savanna as a source of explanations for things.
This, by the way, is real research that's been done. A photograph of a lion on a savanna.
Absolutely.
The Westerner sees the lion and the Easterner sees the savanna.
And its relationship to the lion.
Right.
But it sees all these things in relationship to each other. And also when it tends to sort of, you know, to what does it attribute, you know, a given event. And over again, you will see a Westerner say, oh, it's because of the pit of the lion. And an Easterner will say, it's because of the environment. So, you know, along the same lines, when I look at Jahar Tsarnaev, I could not help but ask the savanna question. Is he just a bad person with a bad pit? Or, you know, was there something in his environment that could have changed? Was there something we could have done?
People didn't want to hear that.
They didn't. Well, this is the big pit thing, you know, is they want to hear that he is a lion and the problem lies with his pit. That is often true in many circumstances, but we have to admit that there is the possibility that sometimes the problem is not with the pit of the lion. Sometimes the problem is with the savanna.
Yeah. That's Gish Jen. Her book is The Girl at the Baggage Claim, Explaining the East-West Culture Gap. Gish, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We spoke last March. If you missed the book then, lucky you, it's out in paperback tomorrow. This is Here and Now. Remember during that televised meeting with lawmakers last week, President Trump suggested they go back to earmarks, pork barrel spending, to get to a deal. Everybody laughed. Earmarks, a symbol of corruption, were banned in 2011. But the president might have known Republicans are holding hearings this week about possibly bringing them back. NPR's Ron Elving is here. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Robin.
So start with the fact that President Trump, who promised to drain the swamp, and of course his party along with him, are leading a push for earmarks. Earmarks were considered the swamp. So is that politically dangerous?
You know, you surely would think they would be totally toxic at this point, considering all the fuss that was made about them back in the heyday when they were banned. If you go back a decade, there were people going to jail because of bribery schemes based largely in the earmarking process. It had become a kind of cottage industry. John McCain based his 2008 campaign for president largely on a pledge to outlaw earmarks. This is a different time in Washington, and for at least a lot of the Republicans, a green light from the White House means it's safe to proceed.
Well, as we said, people went to jail. A California lawmaker used earmark money to pay off people who were giving him gifts. I mean, tell us how bad it got, but then also what were normal earmarks?
California lawmaker Duke Cunningham from Southern California, Republican, was a chairman of a subcommittee on the Appropriations Committee, and so he was in charge of a lot of money getting distributed in the defense industry. And he, at one particular point in his career, was sitting down to meals with defense contractors and handing over a napkin on which he had written a list of prices for certain earmarks that he could get into bills. And if he were to do that for them, they were to do such and such for him in terms of cash, in terms of gifts. That's bribery. That's plain old corruption. The typical kind of earmarking was something more like a subcommittee chairman setting up an operation in which lobbyists could come in and talk to his staff and say, this is what so-and-so wants, and this is what so-and-so wants, and if we put this together with that, we can get more people to vote for the bill. Now, that did not involve bribes, but it did involve committing federal spending in certain directions in order to get people to vote for a bill they otherwise might not have voted for, and you can come up with your own name for that.
Well, and Oklahoma Republican Rep. Tom Cole told Politico that changes have been made in the House that would prevent the kind of misuse of spending you were talking about. Cole says there's roadblocks to that now.
Yes, and Tom Cole is an appropriator. He's a Rules Committee member. He surely knows the system well. He knows things that could be done to improve it. He says it needs to be more transparent. Every single one of these needs to have a name on it. You can't slip them in, you know, anonymously as members used to do. And he also says that they could be carefully examined to make sure that there was no waste, fraud, or abuse, and that all of this could be done through a process. But that means you couldn't be just handing these out at the last minute, which is the main way they were used as lubricant to get these spending bills passed if they didn't have enough votes. So the real question is, if you totally sanitize earmarks, are they really the aid to passage that they were in the past?
Yeah. And why else are those who want to bring earmarks back saying they want that? What other reasoning is given?
As the president was saying, the system lends itself to not working. The system is difficult. And if you can't get everybody on board for a bill that has a lot of controversial spending in it, you can warm them up to it by giving them a little piece of the controversial spending, giving them some that's not controversial in their district because it satisfies some specific need.
So they're saying that it will end the gridlock that we're seeing. But is it also about taking back spending power? In other words, power that's now, you know, outside of Congress with agencies and such?
Yes. And Tom Cole, who is a strong institutionalist and a strong conservative, both from Oklahoma, a Republican, will tell you that this represents a major sacrifice, a ceding of power, a giving up of the responsibility of Congress to have the power of the purse and giving it to the executive. And of course, that doesn't mean just the White House. It means the entire bureaucracy to decide where federal spending goes. In theory, that executive branch and that bureaucracy decides where it's needed most, where it can be used most efficiently, where the bridges should go, where they're most needed, and not the sort of bridge that got famous as the bridge to nowhere up in Alaska, connecting a small town to an almost totally unpopulated island. The price tag was $320 million had it been built, but it was mostly a favorite of former Senator Ted Stevens, who was the Republican from Alaska at the time and the chairman of the Appropriations Committee in the Senate.
Yeah. So that became a symbol, the bridge to nowhere. And even now, even though the Republican majority House is going to be having these hearings, not all Republicans are in line with this idea of bringing back earmarks.
No. Already the head of the House Freedom Caucus has expressed a lot of reservations about it. And the fate of this idea of going back to earmarking depends entirely on whether or not it becomes a populist issue in the months ahead. And if there's a lot of grassroots resistance, it's going to be way too hot to handle in the election year. And we are most certainly entering the election year.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.